boats and ships, headed for shore. The gentle tide lapped on the shoreline, and the world waited.
And now there's a signal from the flagship.
All hands to beaching station.
That's the signal for our sailors on board this craft to get ready for the landing.
Now the ships are sealed, and we wait. Troops swarmed up the rope ladders last night. Strong, healthy, formidable men. Many of them going into battle for the first time.
Allied armies in Normandy push closer tonight to their immediate objective.
Soon the air grew heavy with the smell of cordite and loud with the sound of explosions. And looking along the beach, we could see the explosions of our artillery creating a great fog.
The sea was calm to moderate. The sky slightly overcast. Then the sound of 7,000 boats and ships broke the silence.
This is the day, and this is the hour. All the ships are blazing away now. There are ships moving in, ships on patrol, ships circling, ships standing to and firing. You can't imagine anything like this march of ships, like soldiers marching in line.
On the eve of this great adventure, I send my best wishes to every soldier in the Allied team. To us is given the honor of striking a blow for freedom which will live in history.
One day in June, while the world awoke to a new day at war, 160,000 fathers, sons, brothers, headed for five fateful beaches in France.
People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe.
The people of Normandy are celebrating their liberation. The church bells are ringing, and the villagers are going to mass to give thanks for their freedom.
In 1991, the world witnessed the incredible sight of the first ever live televised war zone. Bearing witness to war on live television is something we now take for granted. Three quarters of a century ago, as the most terrifying and devastating world war in history raged on, everyday people had two choices. Read about events days after they happened in newspapers, or hear rich, textured, often visceral war reports on the radio. On Tuesday, June the 6th, 1944, the Allied armies carried out a series of monumental landings on the beaches of northern France. The event marked the beginning of the end of World War II. This was D-Day. This top-secret operation was slowly, carefully revealed to a war-weary public through an incredible series of groundbreaking radio broadcasts. These are D-Day's sound stories. In late spring 1944, the world has been at war for almost 5 years. 3 years earlier, Britain's Prime Minister had promised,
"We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be."
Now, the tide was turning for the Allies. Churchill, knowing what lay ahead in the weeks to come, addressed the nation on May the 26th, just 11 days before D-Day.
"Since I spoke to you last, not only have the Hun invaders been driven from the lands they had ravaged, but the guts of the German army have been largely torn out by Russian valor and generalship. The hour of our greatest effort and action is approaching. And when the signal is given, the whole circle of avenging nations will hurl themselves upon the foe and batter out the life of the cruelest tyranny which has ever sought to bar the progress of mankind."
Words our connection with the events of spring 1944. As the war continued into its fifth year, everyday people relied on papers and the radio to connect them with events around them. On June 4th, 1944, Frank Gillard, a trusted BBC correspondent, described the preparations throughout southern England for the secret operation ahead.
England has become one vast ordnance dump and field park. I've driven through it today for the best part of 100 miles. The roads crammed with military traffic and lined, often enough on both sides, with vehicles of all kinds, just pulled off and parked on the verges. There's plenty of cover to be had at this time of the year, and for all its concentration, this stuff is well hidden from observation from above. In every wood and copse, in leafy dead-end lanes and side roads, often in private gardens, under quarries and embankments, there it all was. Trucks, ambulances, tanks, armored cars, carriers, jeeps, bulldozers, ducks, vehicles of all kinds. Vast, really vast numbers of them. The people who actually live in these parts must feel as if some mammoth circus has suddenly sprung up round them. Certainly, in the whole history of the world, there never has been such a vast concentration of all the paraphernalia of war in so small a space. Right in the midst of it all, just as I turned for home, I passed a field where 22 men in khaki shirts and battle-dress trousers and heavy hobnail boots were having a quiet knock-up game of cricket. They made me think of Francis Drake and Plymouth Hoe.
They made me think of Francis Drake and Plymouth Hoe.
When we think about war, we often think about guns, planes, tanks, ships, uniforms. But war is about people. The people fighting, and the people left behind at home, waiting, hoping that the person they love would come home again, one day. When the signal was given, it would send 163,000 men to the beaches of northern France. All of them wanted to get the job done. They all wanted the chance to go home again.
Hello, BBC. This is Colin Wills, recording on a quayside in Britain on June the 3rd, 1944. Across this quayside moves a stream of men, great men, men of peace going to war. They will be among the first Allied troops who will assault Hitler's fortress. These particular troops embarking here are British. Ahead of them lies Europe, behind them lies Britain. Many of them glance back as they march for a last glimpse of their own country. Some of them shout farewells, some of them sing, some are silent, some of them laugh, some smile, some look thoughtful, some look grim. One thing is common to them, an unmistakable air of purpose and resolve. They count it a high honor to be chosen for this job. They'll do that job as well as any men who could be chosen for it. They look superbly fit. They're supremely high-spirited. They're sublimely dedicated to their task. They march in battle dress with camouflaged steel helmets with packs on their back, with rifles and automatic weapons and other weapons of various kinds. They have to carry a lot of war material with them because they're part of the spearhead. I talked with them as they waited their turn to embark. Two things were in all their minds: the job that lay ahead and the homes they left behind.
By land, by sea, by air, paratroopers were a relatively new invention. Soldiers who jump from a plane and float to the ground beneath a silky canopy, while avoiding flak, bullets, and hundreds of other aeroplanes and gliders. On D-Day, tens of thousands of Allied soldiers made that fateful jump into battle.
We're over the enemy coast now, and the run-in has started. 1 minute, 30 seconds, red light, green light, and out, out, get on, get out, get out. Out fast into the cool night. Out, out into the air over France. And we know that the dropping zone is obstructed. We're jumping, in fact, into fields covered with poles. But I hit my chute and lower my kit bag, which suspends on the end of a 40-foot rope from my harness. And then the ground comes up to hit me, and I find myself in the middle of a cornfield. The whole sky now is a fantastic chimera of lights and flak, and one plane gets hit and disintegrates wholesale, sprinkling a myriad of burning pieces all over the sky.
Travel by sea to France today is ordinary, every day. 75 years ago, the journey was charged with tension. Huddled aboard a troop transporter, BBC War Unit correspondent Robin Duff shared the journey with one of the ships carrying part of the 200,000-strong invasion force as they prepared for H-hour on D-Day.
It's 20 minutes to 8 in the evening. A man and I have only a few hours to H-hour. At any time now, we may see action. At any moment, the German advanced defences may come into play. And so, while we steam steadily along a course that's carrying us south towards the Seine, I'm taking this chance of recording. At noon today, we raised anchor, and we were ready to go. Slowly and majestically, as minesweepers and destroyers curved their way into position, we gave the lead to the other transport. Under a grey sky, we looked at the coast of Britain and watched it slowly grow more dim. It was a roomful of men on the way, wondering, waiting, and listening. On deck, signals were flashing between ships. Enterprise had run up a flag signal. Boat crews were making their final preparations. There was a tenseness and a sense of good humor and good fellowship that were impossible of translation into words. And now, as the time draws near for darkness, and we sail steadily nearer to the coastline of France, most of those same things are still happening. Every man is wondering. Every man is completely calm.
By sea, by land, D-Day was an almighty endeavour that could only succeed with a united military operation. On June the 5th, correspondent Stuart McPherson shared a top-secret briefing as the bomber crew supporting the imminent landings prepared themselves for the almighty challenges.
The briefing room is in a Nissen hut, and in a great many ways is exactly like any other briefing room. At the front of the room are huge operational maps showing everything there is to know of enemy-occupied territory, particularly the coastal stretches. Quite some minutes ago, I thought that it would be impossible to get any more men in this room, but still they come, all wearing battle dress, many of them carrying maps in their boot tops, most of them with thick, warm-looking sweaters rolled up to their neck. There's rather a tense atmosphere in the room, for the lads are certain that, as they say, this is it. But they're laughing and talking as they tumble in from outside. They joke and jostle each other. And now the commanding officer, the young RAF wing commander, has come in, and in a few minutes, these young flyers will hear the briefing that they've been waiting 4 years to hear. Their orders to provide air cover for the armies of liberation. And now he's ready, they're all quietened down, and we'll listen to the wing commander.
Well, this is it, boys. D-Day when the American and our own forces go into the continent is sometime early tomorrow morning. Now, our job tomorrow and for the succeeding few days is to maintain a complete air superiority so that the Army and the Navy can get on with their job.
These fighter pilots do not look on this job as adventurous. To them, it is a grim job of work that has to be done, and done thoroughly. They want to get back to doing the things in life they want to do, live their own life. And as I watch them file out of that briefing, I think that they are a good bet to do just that thing.
How do you inspire and motivate people to walk into danger? On the eve of the Allied invasion of Nazi-occupied Europe, just as tens of thousands of troops prepared to leave for the Normandy beaches, the commander of ground forces on June 6th, General Bernard Montgomery, used optimism about a bright future as he addressed his troops.
On the eve of this great adventure, I send my best wishes to every soldier in the Allied team. To us is given the honor of striking a blow for freedom which will live in history. And in the better days that lie ahead, men will speak with pride of our doings. We have a great and a righteous cause. Let us pray that the Lord, mighty in battle, will go forth with our armies, and that his special providence will aid us in the struggle. I want every soldier to know that I have complete confidence in the successful outcome of the operations that we are now about to begin. With stout hearts, And with enthusiasm for the contest, let us go forward to victory.
It's early morning. You're on the deck of a ship in the English Channel. You're surrounded by men, ships, aircraft, and a feeling of anticipation. It's 5 minutes until hundreds of thousands of people from both sides of a five-year war will bear arms against each other. This was the moment the BBC's Michael Standing picked up his bulky recorder and told his story about D-Day.
Just 5 minutes before HR, H-5, and looking straight in towards the coastline of France, watching on the horizon, for we're anchored some distance out, the flashes of the guns from destroyers that are in there, opening up on the beach and the coastal batteries nearby. Our assault craft are now out of sight, lost in the lowering cloud by the beaches. The first tanks that lead the assault will be on the beaches and opening up with their guns. We, standing here, wish those boys who've gone in all the luck in the world.
All the boats, ships, and fighting men headed towards a 50-mile stretch of the coast divided into five sectors: Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juno, and Sword. Strong winds blew their landing craft east of their intended targets. They landed under heavy fire from gun emplacements, and the shore was mined and covered with obstacles such as wooden stakes. Later, some would describe it as the nearest thing they could imagine to hell on earth.
This is the day and this is the hour. The sky is lightening. Along the shore, there's a dense smoke screen as the battleship and the warship sweep along, firing all the time against the shore, and some of them laying a smoke screen for us. The sea is a glittering mass of silver, with all these craft of every kind moving across it, and the great battleships in the background blazing away at the shore.
June the 6th, 1944. Morning. As people throughout Britain turned on their radios, this was the news they heard.
This is London. London calling in the home, overseas, and European services of the BBC and through United Nations Radio Mediterranean. And this is John Snagg speaking. Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force, have just issued communique number one. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
The latest news from the NBC newsroom in New York. Here is Don Hollenbeck.
Allied armies in Normandy push closer tonight to their immediate objectives, the port of Cherbourg and the railway town of Caen, 10 miles inland. An American flying wedge of parachute troops and infantrymen has cut the main line of German communications to Cherbourg by capturing the town of Saint-Mère-Église. Communique number 8 tonight says again, satisfactory progress.
The world in 1944 was a very different place from the world we know today. 75 years ago, the freedom we take for granted was fragile and under daily threat by an aggressive, uncompromising foe.
Hard as it may seem after five long years of war to take a new surge of impulse out of yourselves, every man and every woman in this island must show themselves capable of doing. And I am sure our soldiers at the front will not be found incapable of that extra effort which is necessary to crown all that has been gained, and above all, to bring this frightful slaughter and devastation in Europe to an end.
For most of the people in Britain, D-Day was a distant event, described in news reports. For Alan Melville, D-Day, its sights and unique sounds, happened right in front of him.
Hello everyone, this is Alan Melville speaking from the beach just west of the little village of Ouistreham. The paratroops are landing. They're landing all around me as I speak. They've come in from the sea and they're fluttering down, red, white and blue parachutes fluttering down, and they're just about the best thing that we've seen for a good many hours. I can still see the signs of a typical panzer battle being raged on the slightly high ground just about 3 or 4 miles ahead of me. And these paratroops are coming down between where I'm speaking, which is just above the sand dunes. Down they come. They're being attacked, but they're landing in great force, and they may have a very decisive effect on that battle. The aircraft are sweeping inland, letting go their valuable cargo, sweeping round as if nothing mattered, and tearing again out to sea. And they're still coming in. I'm just turning around to look out to sea, and I can see away out to the very horizon. They're coming in flood after flood.
It was a day like no other. More than 200,000 Allied personnel fought for the freedom of Europe and the world. For most, though, the real story of D-Day came via a few trusted and often brave reporters. As D-Day drew to a close, it was summed up by a familiar voice and now famous name in British broadcasting, Richard Dimbleby.
The British, Canadian and American troops who landed on the coast of France, north of the lovely town of Caen, in broad daylight this morning, are already several miles inland, on a front sufficiently broad to be more than a bridgehead. They are pushing steadily on, backed by the tremendous firepower of heavy British and United States warships, and covered by an ever-changing but ever-present umbrella of fighters. The first phase of the great operation began about midnight last night when a force of parachutists and glider troops, some of which I saw taking off in the dying light of yesterday, landed on the eastern side of the chosen area to secure that flank. Today, the gliders and some of the discarded parachutes lie like crumpled flowers in the wet, wooded countryside northeast of Caen. Evidence enough that our airborne troops have successfully completed this, the first of their operations in the new battle of Europe. If it seems to be relatively quiet on the ground, it is certainly quiet in the air, where the Luftwaffe has simply stayed away. That was the picture at noon today. I feel I should repeat that there may be a change on the way.
To millions of people, the war in Europe was a prison sentence. Trapped as prisoners of occupation in their own cities, towns, villages. As Supreme Commander, Allied Forces on D-Day, Dwight D. Eisenhower had the privilege and burden of letting the people of Europe know that help was coming on D-Day.
People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe, made in conjunction with our great Russian allies. I have this message for all of you. Although the initial assault may not have been made in your own country, the hour of your liberation is approaching. I know that I can count on your steadfastness now, no less than in the past. With the heroic deeds of Frenchmen who have continued the struggle against the Nazis and their Vichy satellites in France and throughout the French Empire have been an example and an inspiration to all of us. This landing is but the opening phase of the campaign in Western Europe. Great battles lie ahead. I call upon all who love freedom to stand with us now. Our arms are resolute. Together we shall achieve victory.
11 months after the D-Day landings and the Battle of Normandy, the war in Europe ended. And on August the 15th, 1945, VJ Day marked the formal end of the Second World War. By its end, an estimated 70 to 85 million people had lost their lives. Those who died on D-Day sacrificed their lives to prevent that number from growing even higher and to defend that freedom which we take for granted today. US President Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill's words to the people of the US and Great Britain best sum up the spirit of sacrifice and the yearning to free the world from the oppression of tyranny.
Pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor. A struggle to preserve our republic and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. They fight to liberate. They fight to let justice arise. Some will never return. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country. And with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace. A peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men. And a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. We shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy.
We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be.
D-Day 75, Sound Stories, is an Original Forces program for BFBS. It was narrated by Mark Chadwick and written and produced by Andrew Wright. We dedicate it to the service, duty, and sacrifice given by so many on June the 6th, 1944.
Digital radio, FM, and satellite TV in the UK.
Online and on air, around the world.
This is Forces Radio. Forces Radio.